you here. All right. The first case of the day is 3482, 3491, 3681, United States of America versus Green, Miller, Skrobot, and Brazil. And I take it, Mr. Schindler, you're going to begin?
No, Your Honor. Actually, Mr. Petro is going to start.
Okay.
I took a little brave pill this morning, so I'm going to go first.
A little what?
Brave pill.
No. Yeah, courage, courage, I say. What could make you happier than seeing the three of us? Just think of what it might have been.
Good morning. This is 3681. My name is Michael Petro, and I represent the appellant Alonzo Brazil. The district court's denial of Mr. Brazil for motion for mistrial was an abuse of discretion as a matter of law. In short, the district court erred by allowing the statement of non-testifying co-defendant Donald Thomas to be used as direct evidence against Mr. Brazil at trial. The statement offered by the United States did not allow Mr. Brazil to cross-examine co-defendant Donald Thomas and was in violation of the Sixth Amendment in Bruton versus United States.
Now, let me just go into this a tiny bit with you because our case law says that there is no Bruton issue when one defendant's confession evidence doesn't directly incriminate another defendant, but does so only when linked with evidence that is introduced later at trial. You know, why would that link be a problem here?
Well, in this particular case, Judge, the case law with respect to Bruton has approved uses of these co-defendant statements at trial. To make a long story short, to comport with Bruton, the proposed statement of Donald Thomas, the co-defendant, must be sanitized so that it does not directly point at Mr. Brazil. In short, the proposed statement that the United States offered before trial was sanitized correctly so that it was impossible, the key words, it was impossible for the jury to make a one-to-one correspondence between Mr. Thomas's confession and Mr. Brazil.
But there were two other people were tried with Thomas and Brazil, right? And the jury heard evidence that approximately 20 people were involved in the scheme. So what makes it, you know, the redaction not stand up?
Because in this particular case, during trial, the United States proofs began to unravel. Specifically, the key cooperating witness testified that he was responsible and paid for the creation of bogus closing documents in Mr. Brazil's real estate purchases. To bolster this deficiency, on the fifth day of testimony, the United States asked the district court to change the prior district court approved statement of co-defendant Donald Thomas. This proposed change by the United States substituted a neutral pronoun for Mr. Brazil with the non-neutral word straw buyer. The district court denied the government's proposed change. And despite the second admonition, they put in the statement with the word straw buyer. But not only that, Judge, I just want to tell you, they tied it with a specific property, which right before that point, they told that this property was bought by my client, Alonzo Brazil, and that the straw buyer received a kickback.
I have to tell you, I think this is a very close issue, because the government did promise a more sanitized version, than it delivered. But it still did not reveal his identity, Brazil's identity, directly. And what I have to figure out in my own mind, I guess, is whether the fact that the jury can easily make the link between the property address and Brazil, whether that would make the confession inadmissible. So that's, you know, where I am. Am I making sense to you?
You're absolutely making sense to me, Judge. And what I would say is if you look at my brief at the top of page 15, it actually shows where the government put the proposed statement of Donald Thomas into the record. It says, yes, he told me he received $20,000 for the sale of 14822 South Hoyne in Harvey. We have a specific property. Now, Donald Thomas had sold, I think, six properties or maybe seven properties, and in the original sanitized version, it didn't make specific mention to any of that. But when they put the property in, and then they use the term straw buyer, and then they say that they go on to say that the straw buyer received a kickback for the purchase of that property, there is no doubt that the government's intention was to draw a one-to-one correspondence between my client, Alonzo Brazel, and Donald Thomas's confession. I was not allowed to cross-examine that particular statement as required by the Sixth Amendment, and it runs afoul of the Sixth Amendment for that reason.
Is there any doubt whether Mr. Brazil was the buyer of that property?
Yeah. No, the jury had heard repeatedly that my client, they had seen documents with respect to that particular property.
Was there other evidence indicating that he had received cash as a kickback for the purchase?
There was one incredible witness by the name of James Robert Thomas. He was incredible because of his demeanor at trial. And I think that the reason that the government changed the particular testimony was because of the incredible nature of Mr. Thomas's testimony.
You know, in the brief somewhere, you stated that the simple motivation behind Mr. Brazil was to acquire and maintain ownership of the house, or of a house. Did he actually live in the house he acquired?
He lived in one of the houses that he acquired. With respect to the verification of rents, I think that the evidence at trial that was adduced was that there were actually renters in the property that then vacated the premises. So with respect to the these particular aspects of the case, the government really needed to bolster this particular avenue of the case, and they did so, in my opinion, against order of court and against the Sixth Amendment. And that's why he deserved a mistrial at that point.
Okay. So your red light went on. So I take it, who's number two?
Anthony Birch on behalf of Joseph Miller.
Okay, hi.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please.
We have it in different order. Of course, it's their fault. We know that. No.
May it please the court. I'm Anthony Birch. I'm here this morning on behalf of Joseph Miller. He's asked this court to overturn his conviction of March 12th of 2009 for wire fraud and mail fraud. We submitted to the court that there were two combined issues that basically rendered the trial of Mr. Miller unfair. The first one was undue prejudice by guilt by association with regards to the co-conspirators that were also charged.
You've got a close issue, too, in my mind. And it's this. Was there any evidence in the record that Miller knew what McLeod was doing and vice versa? What I'm trying to figure out is what was the relationship between these two people?
The relationship was that with regards to Mr. Miller, he was a loan officer. So his alleged role in this was basically to prepare documents and to fax them. He was convicted on mail and wire fraud. To specifically answer your question, his role and the independent evidence against Mr. Miller came in the form of two witnesses that basically testified that
I'm only interested right now in Ms. McLeod.
No, Your Honor, there was no direct link between Mr. Miller and Ms. McLeod with regards to any testimony that he did anything illegal with regards to Ms. McLeod. Specifically, with regards to Mr. Miller, there was testimony from two other witnesses that he basically instructed them and on their behalf presented forged documents on which the banks relied and gave out loans. That evidence, as with the other testimony who were all from other co-conspirators, was totally unreliable. They had a reason to lie. their testimony was uncredible, and it was also impeached with regards to the timeline in which they testified. Both of those witnesses, I believe, were impeached on cross-examination, and they were self-serving testimony. That evidence alone would not have...
Give me an example of the impeachment of McLeod. I'm very interested in McLeod.
Your Honor, if I could have one moment.
Yeah, of course. Welcome, whoever you are. I think.
Your Honor, I'm going to apologize this time. I would hate to have to go through my brief again.
All right.
To find a specific instance. But with regards to Mr. Miller, I would just emphasize that the testimony that came in and the evidence against him and the government's position with regards to Mr. Miller, although he was not charged with a conspiracy, he was linked by the proposition of the government, which was there was a conspiracy. Larry Skrobot was the mastermind behind this conspiracy, and that although we are not charging Mr. Miller with a conspiracy, he was a part of it. He was actually found guilty, as I stated before, of wire fraud and mail fraud, both of which he would have done in his job title as a loan officer. They process information and forward that information on. Your Honor, with regards, if he had not been tried with the rest of the co-defendants in this particular matter, we feel as though it's our position that the evidence that was presented against him, specifically with regards to Mr. Miller, would not have been enough to convict him.
Mr. Birch, let me ask you. You were referring to the couple of witnesses you said should not be credited. That was Mr. Hilato and Mr. Marchetti?
Yes,
right? Why isn't that just a jury issue? Can you give me – why isn't it the credibility determination simply something to leave to the jury? What was extraordinary about this case?
What's extraordinary about this case is because in essence, which I believe is dealt with in Bruton, you're asking a jury, there's a conspiracy here, and we want you over several days to connect the dots of these different conspiracies. And at the end of that time, you say, with regards to Mr. Miller, and there was a instruction given by the court that only evidence, each count should be related to each individual person, and only the evidence that went against that person. But that would be, in essence, with regards to a jury, asking them to tie knots for 4 days, and then at the end, on the fifth day, say, make sure the string isn't tangled up. It's too confusing.
I'm asking you, I think, to be more specific about why Hilato's and Marchetti's testimony against your client was so incredible that we should step in and say the jury could not reasonably believe it.
I am saying that in conjunction with their testimony taken alone would not have been that incredible. And I'm not saying that you would overturn a jury just on their evidence and their testimony alone. I am saying that in conjunction with the fact that he was tried along with, I believe, six or seven other individuals that he sat with at a defendant's table where the government put forth the proposition that there's a conspiracy. There's one conspiracy, and everyone had a part. And at the end of that the jury instruction or the instructions of the court to the jury that they should not...
No, keep going.
They should not use all this evidence against Mr. Miller was not enough. It was too confusing.
You say he wasn't charged in the conspiracy?
No, dude. He was charged, but he was not charged as a co-conspirator. He was not charged with the count of conspiracy.
But essentially you're saying because he was sitting at the table with all the co-defendants and it was a long trial, that was the problem. I mean, because you're not saying that there was any credibility problems with the two witnesses.
I am saying that there was a credibility issue with regards to the witnesses, and had it been a trial where he was alone and a jury came back with a decision of guilt or innocence, that's different than when in conjunction where you have a trial and there are credibility issues in conjunction with the issue of a claim of or a theory of a conspiracy, those two combined causes an issue where we believe that Mr. Miller did not have a fair trial.
What U.S. Attorney's Office do you think would have tried him alone? I mean, how would you have tried him alone? It just doesn't compute.
Having not been a U.S. attorney, I'm not sure which U.S. attorneys would try him alone, Your Honor, but we would say that that would not cure him guilt by association. This isn't the law. And that's why we're saying he was convicted.
Thank you very much. Okay, so, Mr. Schindler, we get to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of James Green, Ralph Schindler, Your Honor, we had the, pleasure of being that one person that got tried separately and independently of these other individuals. And so the transcript in our case is totally different than the other two defendants in this appeal that was consolidated before you.
Let me just ask you this, going right into, you know, what I got from the briefs. Suppose Mr. Green did want to fix up properties and make income from them. Would that, in your mind, preclude a finding that he committed a crime by falsifying loan documents?
Your Honor, I don't believe there was evidence that he actually falsified the loan documents. If we go back to the loan documents, I mean, they're...
Joseph Green testify that he provided false information?
I believe Joe Green said that when he came with the... When actually Verena McLeod came with the first set of loan application documents, she said, fill in this information, but leave this information blank. He was supposed to leave the information blank, and it's in the reply brief as... in the appendix, Government Exhibit 2B, the residential loan application, the section here relating to employment information was supposed to be left blank, and he left it blank. Okay, and then subsequently, he finds out that Verena McLeod filled it all in and put in that his employer was the Art of Construction. Now, again, I would ask you to recall that from the transcript, there was only one residential loan application that was made related to the first transaction. And the testimony from Robert Thomas and everybody else was, well, we can use that same loan application for all the other transactions because they all occurred within the next month or month and a half or 2 months, period. So I don't believe he submitted any of these documents. I mean, he
were the signatures on his loan applications ever reviewed by handwriting experts?
After they came back, after there was an investigation and he found out what was on these, yes, that's when he made the complaint to the Office of Banks and Real Estate. He went back to them and said, what is this? This is not my signature. This is not my information on any of these things. And that
he knew he was under investigation at that point.
No, not at that time. This was subsequent. At his first, and I believe the dates were the closings were April, May of 2005. His submission to the Office of Banks and Real Estate, he hired an attorney, and they wrote in their complaint in August of 2005. He hired Ms. Billings, who was an attorney, in August of 2005. He was first contacted by Agent Kaiser, I believe, in October. Subsequent to that, he filed a complaint in the Daily Center, and that was about 9 months after that, and it was that complaint in the Daily Center for fraud where he sued Robert Thomas, and he sued Verena McLeod and James Spina, that Judge Bucklow did not allow into evidence. But the complaint against the Office of Banks and Real Estate in August of 2005, she did allow into evidence, and that was before he was contacted by Agent Kaiser, I believe. I think in terms of, Mr. Green testified on his own behalf, and the testimony that he gave, I believe, was very credible, and it was actually supported by the government's own agents in terms of what was the deal, as Your Honor suggested. I mean, it was clear from all the testimony, Joe Green, James Green, Robert Thomas, that the deal was that we're going to buy these properties, we're going to fix them up, we're going to rehab them, and we're going to get them set for Section 8 tenants so that the cash flow on these things would pay the mortgages. That was always the deal. That was everybody's testimony, is that that was, in fact, the deal. So, and the problem, of course, came about that even though everybody knew that was the deal, Robert Thomas didn't comply with the deal. He didn't rehab the properties. He didn't pay the mortgages during the rehab period, as he promised to do. And that's why all these things eventually failed. Now, but on the other issue, I think there's a legitimate issue here in terms of the 902 certifications. I mean, before we even went to trial, there was an objection made to the 902 certification in that the co-defendant, Charlene Batala, is doing a business record certification. These records here, the Government Exhibit 2B and the rest of these in the appendix, well, we're all certified as business records by Charlene Batala, the co-defendant, as being true and accurate business records. And they all bear the signature of James Green. So the first moment of trial, the government presents a trial book with all these exhibits in them and moves for their admission. And the judge rules that they are admitted. And the organization of these exhibits, they were arranged by property address. They're not arranged by these were Equity Express documents or these were from this other loan document. They were.
Did you go into court when you received all of these documents and say, look, I can't, you know, this is untenable?
I made some objection on when they first came up, but basically the judge had already ruled that they were admissible due to the denial of the motion in limine. There was a motion in limine, and it was fully briefed as part of the docket record, but she allowed all these things in, saying that the certification of Charlene Batala and I believe Verena McLeod even, I think, made some certification for those records too. But
let me ask you, those Equity Express exhibits, because I know you're troubled by those, the fact that they were admitted.
Yeah.
Right. Did the government ever use or refer to them during trial?
Yes, absolutely. I think they were, again, arranged property by property, and they were presented, like the first one, the Government Exhibit 2B, 14-18 Portland. They were introduced, you know, as
because, if... No, the government makes a statement in its brief that certain documents from Equity Express were admitted but were never really used. So that's why I asked you to clarify that.
Well, they're there, and they've got the guy's signature on them, so I think that the jury certainly had them back when they were deliberating.
I mean, I really understand that there were, you know, many, many documents for the defense to go through, and they came in, you know, they were presented in a way that was, I should say, I suppose, organized and presented in a way that... you maintain you couldn't tell which were certified by Batella and which were certified by McLeod. And you did not, I take it, renew your motion that you could not get a handle on each and every document because of the way...
I made an objection to some of the documents because they were illegible or irrelevant, but I did not renew my objection under the 902 certification, again, because the court had already ruled on that. So I didn't think it was necessary to at that point in time, renew the objection.
You know, I understand that it puts lawyers, you know, sort of between a rock and a hard place. On the other hand, I suppose no matter what, you need to always be thinking about coming up stairs or whatever we call ourselves here.
Yes, Your Honor. But in any event, I see my time is up. So I would ask the court to review this case and particularly to review the testimony of Mr. Green. And it's a rare occasion when we actually have the defendant take the stand and testify in his own behalf. And I believe he's a fine young man, and he was, in this case, definitely a victim of the scheme and not a participant in the scheme. And therefore, we would ask the court to reverse this case in Mr. Green's favor.
Thank you, Mr. Schindler. Okay. So, hi, Mr. Stettler. How are you?
Good, Your Honor. How are you?
I'm... Yeah. That's a big deal, huh?
Please the court. Good morning. My name is Chris Stetler, and I represent the United States.
Okay.
Mr. Brazil forfeited his Bruton argument prior to the testimony at issue coming in.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to get right to it. If you go back and you read the transcripts at the pretrial hearing on the Bruton issue, the government promised a very specific and very sanitized version of Thomas's statement that would only refer to Mr. Brazil as a straw buyer. Is there any place in that transcript that you can point to where we will find that the government informed the court that it would be identifying the property purchased by the straw buyer?
Yeah, I believe in the pretrial motion that you're referring to, Your Honor, the specific coin property was mentioned. The specific coin property, and that's the property that Donald Thomas referred to in his statement, was mentioned in that pretrial motion by the government. And then additionally, prior to this testimony coming in, the government, in the presence of the court and all the parties, indicated exactly what would be said using the term straw buyer, and so laid it all out in front of the court and the parties. The district court specifically asked Mr. Brazil's counsel whether or not there was an objection, and no objection was raised.
I hope, Mr. Petro, you'll respond to that when you come up. Okay.
And assuming there was a Bruton problem, you know, what give us a nutshell of what evidence there was against Brazil.
There was an abundance.
And otherwise, looking at it from a harmless error standpoint.
Yes, Your Honor. There was an abundance of evidence implicating Mr. Brazil in the scheme. First of all, we heard at trial Keenan Haynes, who was the owner of AOK Construction, testified. And he testified that Mr. Brazil and James Robert Thomas, who was one of the co-schemers, met with Mr. Haynes prior to any of these transactions going forward. And at that time, all three of them discussed getting false employment information. And so James Robert Thomas, in the presence of Mr. Brazil, asked Mr. Haynes if he could provide false verifications of employment for Mr. Brazil. And then also during that meeting, Mr. Brazil wrote down on a piece of paper the income that he was requesting Mr. Haynes to reflect on those verifications of employment, along with other information about that false position. Mr. Haynes also testified that Mr. Brazil paid him money for doing that for Mr. Brazil. And then also after lenders and the FBI started asking questions about the scheme, Mr. Brazil approached Mr. Haynes and basically offered him hush money so that he wouldn't come forward and say anything about the scheme. In addition to that, Your Honor, Mr. Brazil provided a statement to law enforcement in which he said that the down payment money that was offered up in connection with these properties was not given by himself. It was provided by others. James Robert Thomas was also a witness in this case. He testified that he told Brazil that false information was going to be submitted to the lenders, false documentations, down payment monies, false seller second mortgages. And then also James Robert Thomas testified that throughout the course of the scheme, Mr. Brazil complained to him about the amount of money that he was receiving, kind of that was not reflected on these statements. So there was an abundance of evidence against Mr. Brazil in terms of harmless error.
What is your best case to support the sophisticated means enhancement? In other words, are there any cases with very similar fact scenarios involving false W-2s, pay stubs, employment verification forms, or these types of recruiting efforts?
I believe the Knox case, Your Honor, is a 2010 case. I believe that's the mortgage fraud case that we refer to in our brief that does involve many of the same procedures that the scheme in this case used. The case refers to mortgage lenders being tricked into financing properties at prices far exceeding the real property value by falsifying.
Your voice up a little. I know, but
I apologize, Your Honor.
I'm used to screaming at people, so.
Okay, I'll do my best. The case refers to mortgage lenders being tricked into financing properties at prices far exceeding the real property value by falsifying the prospective buyer's loan applications and other information. That was exactly what was done in this case. This case used several people with very specific roles. It involved the use of false documentation. And then in terms of the cover-up procedures that were used, you had people such as Keenan Haynes who backstopped the false information that was presented to these lenders.
Let's get to...
Could I just take you back to the Bruton issue for a moment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you address how you think this case compares with the Hoover case, where the references were inadequately masked, were to the incarcerated leader of the gang and the unincarcerated leader of the gang, where that is, where the other evidence in the trial specifically identified who was being referred to?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in Hoover, one of the main aspects in that case was that Mr. Hoover operated the gang from inside the prison, and that was a theme that that was throughout the trial. And then also, I believe it was Mr. Snell was the person who operated the gang from outside of prison. So at the time that the statement was offered, referring to Hoover as the incarcerated leader and Mr. Snell as the unincarcerated leader, there was no doubt in the jurors' minds because they had heard all this evidence.
Is there any doubt here as to who the straw buyer on the Hoyne property was?
I believe there was at the time it was offered.
Does the order make a difference?
The order of, I'm sorry.
Of whether the linkage is established later or when the co-defendant's confession is offered?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. And just
okay. I thought that's how you were trying to distinguish Hoover.
No. I apologize. I think it's in terms of the obviousness in terms of in Hoover, one of the main themes throughout the trial was that Mr. Hoover was the person who operated this gang from inside.
Was there any doubt here that Brazil was the buyer of the Hoynes property?
There was not any doubt that he was the purchaser of the property, but I think when you look at that in terms of a scheme involving 75 different loans, Judge Williams referred to 20 different purchasers.
You're suggesting the jury was just confused and that therefore it's the jury could have been confused and it was therefore a sufficient masking?
Not that the jury was confused, Your Honor, but I think the point I'm trying to make is that at the time that the statement was offered, it's not as though throughout the trial Mr. Brazil was referred to specifically as Hoyne property purchaser. Mr. Brazil himself had purchased three different properties. So even beyond the 75 different loans, the other defendants that were sitting at defense table.
I think what you're telling me is it's okay to do this in a big, long, complicated trial, but it wouldn't be if this were a trial of the Hoynes Avenue property alone.
I think it would be a much closer case if this was a case involving one fraudulent transaction involving the Hoyne property.
And why the difference, it seems to be, whether the jury would be able to make the link, even though there's only one person who's identified as the Hoynes Avenue buyer in this evidence.
I think it comes down to, Your Honor, at the time that the statement is offered and the extent to which the jury can make an immediate leap to who the statement is referring to. In the Hoover case, it was immediate because throughout the trial, the government had referred to Mr. Hoover as running the operation from jail. In this case, Mr. Brazil was one of dozens of purchasers, and he and himself had purchased other properties as well.
I'm going to, let's go on to Verena McLeod and the transactions where she assumed the role of loan officer. How can we say that Miller took part in the conspiracy involving those properties? Look, this isn't like a drug case where the illegal sales are fungible. Each sale of each property is identifiable and distinguishable, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And just to be clear, Your Honor, Ms. McLeod didn't work within Mr. Miller's mortgage brokerage firm. Mr. Miller worked for Integrity Mortgage. In fact, Mr. Baffs was his boss, and he testified at trial about Integrity.
Right. So her transactions didn't rely on or aid those transactions in which Miller was the loan officer, did they?
It did in the sense that it was part of the larger scheme.
That's no answer.
I might be confused by your question. I apologize.
I'm trying to figure out how we can say that Mr. Miller took part in the conspiracy that involved the properties that where she assumed the role of loan officer, and I'm having a problem.
Well, the indictment, Your Honor, never charged a conspiracy, and there was no jury instruction for Pinkerton liability. As I understand Mr. Miller's argument, it's essentially a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence. And
all right. Was there any evidence? I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked before, I think. Was there any evidence in the record that Miller knew what McLeod was doing and vice versa? What was the relationship between these two people?
They were both loan officers who would collect and submit false information to lenders in coordination with other players in the scheme. For instance, James Robert Thomas.
Was there any evidence in the record that Miller knew what McLeod was doing?
McLeod specifically, I don't recall any such evidence.
Okay, there wasn't. Okay. Was there any evidence in the record that McLeod knew what Miller was doing?
I can't answer that one way or the other, Your Honor. I can't point you to anything specific. But I think in terms of whether or not there was sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Miller, there clearly was. We heard at trial there was testimony from...
Just not on these counts?
Well, the counts at issue didn't rely on Ms. McLeod. The counts at issue charged Mr. Hilado, or I'm sorry, Mr. Miller, with committing mail and wire fraud with respect to a certain number of properties that he acted as the loan officer for and didn't rely at all on Ms. McLeod.
So why was there a testimony about all this if it doesn't rely at all? I mean, what, just a little extra icing on a cake?
I think Ms. McLeod's testimony comes in with respect to Mr. Green and his challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence, but I think there was more than enough evidence to convict Mr. Miller. At the trial, Mr. Hilado testified, and he testified that Mr. Miller told him that someone else would be paying down payment money. Mr. Miller acted as the loan officer with respect to 20 different properties.
Okay. What counts was he convicted on where she acted as the loan officer?
None, Your Honor. Mr. Miller was convicted.
The evidence came in, or the testimony came in.
You're talking about Ms. McLeod?
Yeah.
I believe Ms. McLeod testified in Mr. Green's trial by way of her. There was a stipulation regarding her grand jury testimony, and so her testimony came in that way with Mr. Green's trial. But Ms. McLeod, I don't recall her being a witness in Mr. Miller's trial. She certainly wasn't a key witness, and she certainly wasn't required.
So are you saying no testimony about her came in during Mr. Miller's during the trial in which Mr. Miller was tried?
I don't think I can make that strong of a statement. I'm just saying that I don't recall her testifying, and she certainly wasn't a key.
No, well, forget about her testifying, but anybody testifying about anything about McLeod and Miller.
With respect to Mr. Miller, he was the one who acted as a loan officer. So he was the one, he didn't have to go through Ms. McLeod. He himself was coordinating between the purchasers of these properties and the lenders. So he was the one himself submitting the fraudulent information
but
to the lenders.
Bottom line, am I off the wall if I think that for the transactions where she had assumed the role of loan officer, Miller was found guilty of taking part in that conspiracy that involved those properties? He was found guilty of those, was he not?
There was no conspiracy charge, Your Honor.
Look, all right, there was no conspiracy, but he's there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the jury's mind, believe me, there was a conspiracy. You know, we're in Alice in Wonderland territory right now.
Well, the counts on which he was convicted, he was the loan officer with respect to those properties. Ms. McLeod was not the loan officer with respect to those properties. And I apologize if I'm not being clear, if the brief wasn't clear.
No, I'm going to have to go back.
Okay.
Or you're going to be here a long time explaining it, Mr. Petro.
And since you mentioned Mr. Green, I just want to understand these Equity Express documents, make sure I've got the record correctly, because my understanding is it was Exhibits 29A through E that were the Equity Express exhibits. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And your statement in your brief says that the government never used or referred to them during trial, and even when the exhibits were admitted, the government did not explain or ask the witness to explain their significance. So that's a true statement.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So what was the point of putting the documents in? I understand that Green cross-examined on the documents, but what was the point? And they certainly were in front of the jury.
Certainly.
And I guess that was the point, so the jury would have them and they could see them. But it seems odd when there was no explanation, no reference, no anything. Why were the exhibits there?
Right. And the Equity Express exhibits, which are 29A through E, they were moved into evidence at the beginning of trial along with a number of other exhibits. And so I think at the time they were offered, we certainly expected to use them. I don't know why we did not. I know at the time they were offered there was a dispute as to whether or not Verena McLeod would be testifying, and so perhaps she could have used those.
But they were not. Normally what happens is, because I can understand them being admitted at the, you know, assuming there was an error and they were admitted. But normally then when the case goes to the jury, there's a review of the exhibits to determine which exhibits should really go back and which ones shouldn't. Now, I understand counsel cross-examined some on the documents, so clearly those maybe should have gone back because he cross-examined on them. But, you know, why did he even go back to the jury? If there was no reference, I take it there was no reference to it in the closing argument?
No reference in the closing argument or with respect to any government witness from the government standpoint.
But they went back to the jury room.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's the last page of the trial transcript
mm-hmm.
says that they did go back.
I'm pretty sure they went back, but I just kind of mystifying.
Yeah.
Let me follow up a little bit on this Rule 90211 problem that we're talking about, because I think all of us understand there are situations where business records would come in. If the issue is what information was in front of the lender to make a decision, then obviously this kind of certification would seem to be a pretty straightforward way to do it. But in a trial against the borrower where there's an issue where there are issues as to whether he in fact provided this information. The 90211 certification doesn't tell you who provided the information. It doesn't authenticate signatures. it doesn't really provide a foundation for using that information against Green. And the I noted that the district judge in this case relied on a D.C. Circuit opinion, U.S. against Ada Fahinti, which was quite careful in discriminating the permissible and impermissible uses of this kind of certification. And here it looks like it just was used wholesale.
With respect to the Equity Express records, it was used wholesale.
So it was or was not?
It was.
Yeah, okay.
So I think that's...
Against Green, right?
Correct. But just to make something clear right at the outset, at the time these were introduced, the court had held a series of hearings on these. The government had allowed the defense to come over and see exactly which documents were coming in with respect to the certifications. It heard arguments from all sides, and it looked at the 90211 certification of Ms. Batala. And by the way, Ms. Batala was the only person from Equity Express who did certify the records. And it determined that 90211, which was made under penalty of perjury, was sufficiently reliable. And then,
but that doesn't authenticate signatures, for example, does it?
That does not. And I think the
so how can you use that certification, for example, to put in the loan application as evidence against Green? When it's got his signature on it, there's some issue as to whether it's authentic or whether he signed it before other information was provided.
I think that the purpose of using the 90211 with respect to these Equity Express records, the way these came in, there was a cover sheet from the Equity Express that included information regarding these loans. So, for instance, there was the name of the borrower, there was the lender information, who the title company was, basic background information on each transaction. And then behind that cover sheet were the loan documents, which came in through other exhibits and other 90211s, which are not at issue here. But those were essentially the Equity Express records were essentially duplicative of other exhibits that were introduced at trial.
And how do we follow that trail? That, frankly, sounds like quite a challenge.
Yeah.
And an important one.
Yes, Your Honor. Perhaps I could supplement the record so that a comparison could be made with respect to those exhibits.
With appropriate cross-references where you've got multiple support for the particular exhibits we're talking about, the Equity Express exhibits, I think that would be very important and useful.
Yes, Your Honor. And then also, if taking a look at the record and document entries.
Let me stop you for a minute. We'll send an order out, but we'll, of course, give the defense an opportunity to respond.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But we're going to, look, this is a mess.
Now, I also want to clarify what Defendant Green's position was with respect to these documents, because there was some discussion and dialogue about it, and there was an objection, and the court asked what the objection was, and the response was most of the objections are irrelevant, and not, the document not being clear, and so I guess I'm curious as to were there other objections made other than the objections made at pretrial to these documents?
In addition to the pretrial objections and
yes.
the objections that were raised at the time they were introduced, there's nothing additional.
And were the signatures on Mr. Green's loan applications ever reviewed by handwriting experts for the government?
Not at trial, no. But I believe Joe Green testified that he did witness Defendant Green sign one of the loan applications. I believe it was during a closing.
Okay, so no handwriting experts by the government?
That's correct. There were, I believe, as part of the loan documents that were introduced through 90211s, independent of Charlene Batalas, and those are docket entries 307, 325, 332, and 333, handwriting exemplars that were, or not exemplars, but signature affidavits that were submitted in connection with these loans.
Mr. Could you review for me what loan documents beyond these that are in question now that relate to this signature were admitted with respect to Mr. Green? I think that's what we're talking about.
The 90211 records that came in through Ms. Batalas certification?
Yeah, well, I mean, what other documents were there that there was evidence of the loan, or was this the sole documents that came in through her?
There were other 90211s from the lenders. So any loan file, I think it was group exhibits 2, 5, 6, and 7, would have been certified by witnesses from the lenders. There were also bank statements and bank information that came in through 90211s that were signed by witnesses from the banks. But I think if you...
Those sound easy,
right,
by comparison.
Yes.
Yeah, so, but, and that's so part of why I wanted to just get an idea of how many other documents there were that were admitted against him and
right.
the counts that relates to, because that relates to the same counts that are under question here in terms of this authentication. Is that right?
That's right.
So there was no question about the authentication of those documents.
Exactly, Your Honor.
The lender. So we're talking about just this discrete amount. But there was other evidence to support it. I just wanted to make sure I had the record clear.
No, that's correct.
We've asked you so many questions. If you want to take a couple of minutes, you know, what you really wanted to argue, I'm going to give it to you.
Well, I think I've covered everything in answering your questions. Unless there are additional questions, I would end by asking the court to affirm the convictions and the sentences. That
I don't blame you for wanting to sit down. Thank you, Mr. Stetler. Okay, Mr. Petro, you're up first. How much time does Mr. Petro have left? Well, let's add another minute and a half. Give him 3 minutes, please.
Judge, I just want to make it clear that before trial, the word straw buyer was never approved for any of the buyers of these particular properties. If you look at the government submission, which is contained in my appendix, section 3, page 10, which specifically lays out the testimony of Donald Thomas, the word buyer was used, and then the buyer was associated with three different properties with respect to three different defendants. There was no one-to-one correlation. That complied with Bruton. The word straw buyer was never used in the original submission. Now, they asked to use the word straw buyer at trial, and I did object. And at the end of all this discussion about this, whether this would be allowed, the judge says, I assume that the government is going to limit the statements to what's in its motion. And the government replied, yes, judge. That could not be a clearer admonition by the court. And that could not be a clearer affirmance on behalf of the government in that particular sentence. I mean, in that particular situation. With respect to your question, Judge Hamilton, I just think that the difference between Hoover in this particular case is that in Hoover, if you look at Hoover closely, when they use the terms incarcerated leader and unincarcerated leader, those terms were submitted to the district court judge, and they were given over objection of the defense. In this particular instance, the use of the word straw buyer, the use and the drawing of a direct connection between straw buyer and a particular property was never approved by the court. And the thing that the government cannot explain in this particular case, one part of the particular statement that they used was never approved by the court, and that's where they tie a specific amount of a kickback to the purchaser of the straw buyer to the particular property, this 14822 Point property in Harvey. Those were never approved by the court at any time, at any place. So I want to be clear about that, and I think that what the government did, the trial was, the documents were an absolute mess, but when the government agrees to do something and the court orders them to do something, we have to take that very, very seriously, Judge, and I think that they did violate Mr. Brazel's rights, and he should have received a mistrial. Thank you.
2.5 minutes. That's great. Mr. Birch, come on up. How much time? Give him 3 minutes.
Thank you. I just wanted to reiterate with regards to what our actual position is. Our position is that had this trial gone to trial without the overarching theme submitted by the government that there was a conspiracy, a large conspiracy, the evidence that was and the testimony that was given against Mr. Miller from Pilato and Marchetti would not have been enough. And the vigorous cross-examination and the impeachment would have likely had a different result. That in conjunction, their testimony in conjunction with the overarching theme of a conspiracy is really what led to the conviction of Mr. Miller. And it was really, for lack of a better term, guilt by association, not based upon the evidence that was presented against Mr. Miller. With regards to the comparison of Ms. McLeod and Mr. Miller, it was totally different set of circumstances. I believe there was evidence that Ms. McLeod got kickbacks or extra money from deals that she was a loan officer on and submitted fraudulent documents. There was no testimony, there's no evidence that Mr. Miller ever received anything other than the money that he would have normally received processing loans as a loan officer. As a matter of fact, I believe that there was testimony from Thomas with regards to why Scrobot, the alleged mastermind of this conspiracy, why he used Mr. Miller, and that was because Miller was fast and reliable, not that he was a part of any larger scheme. So based upon that, Your Honor, we would request that the conviction of Mr. Miller is overturned.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Schindler. How much time does Mr. Three.
Your Honor, I just need a couple minutes. And I guess what I'd like to do is talk about the 902 certification for 1 minute. When we first saw the loan documents, there was a stack of documents, yay high, and on top of it was a 902 certification. I, so-and-so, an officer of such-and-such, certify that these are true and accurate business records maintained in the ordinary course of business. Okay. And I guess my objection, first asked to Batala, as a co-defendant, she shouldn't be making that certification. But I also have the same objection as to everyone else who made the same certification, because it's known that in those pile of documents are, in fact, signatures of James Green that are not authentic signatures. So I would suggest that the 902 certification presented a Crawford issue, and that individual should have been called to the stand to say, these are my documents maintained in the ordinary course of business, and I could have cross-examined him and said, well, you don't know whether, in fact, that is James Green's signature on there, do you, or do you not? And he would have to say, no, I don't know whether it is or is not. All I know is it was Verena McLeod obtained the document. And so I think there's a Crawford issue as to Group Exhibits 2, 5, 6, and 7 and the rest of the documents as well. So those documents are testimonial in nature in that they say to the jury, here's James Green, he testified, or he signed these documents, and they're presented by the government as if true and accurate. And therefore, I think there's a Crawford issue. The documents are testimonial, and the 902.11 certification should not have been allowed at all in that context. And so in that vein, I would suggest that the total use of or the presentation of those documents, especially in the format in which they were presented, was error and reversible error. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thanks to all counsel. Of course, the case will be taken under advisement. And as you see, you were cut down to 25 minutes aside, but we gave you the full hour. Aren't we magnanimous? Thank you.